This is the third day of this June 2010 session. And before we go into paramitas, let me point out that we just said this earth where we stand is a pure lotus land. This earth where we stand, where we sit right now. This land. It's the purest lotus land. And this very body, this body, the body of Buddha, not that one, not that one, not that one, not that one, the teacher of the teacher of the teacher of the teacher back to the Buddha. This one, this very body, the body of Buddha, brings everything, the whole chanting, it brings it down. This moment, this very moment, this earth, this body, this practice, this practice. We go around looking for other lands in our practice here, thinking that there's something to be found far away from ourselves. And the teacher must know, the teacher of the teacher must know, why don't I know? Why don't I have it firsthand? That this very body, with all its pains and aches and doubts and feelings, confusion, is the body of Buddha. Nothing else. Just the breath. Just your koan. Doesn't matter which. Matters is the deep concentration, going come back to it, back to it, back to it, willing to drop all our ideas, notions, experiences, this and that. Trying to work on the second paramita and going through different authors. I found that in The Myth of Freedom by Trungpa, he has a kind of a he's describing the path of the Bodhisattva, and of course the path of the Bodhisattva is the path of the 10 precepts. And so he describes it as a part of the Bodhisattva path, but it's the ten paramitas, where each, they call them bhumis, a bhumi, and that's the what the Bodhisattva expresses. So you work on these paramitas to become, or to express, not to become, we already are, but to express our bodhisattvic nature. The second paramita is called morality. It's also been called discipline. And I like talking about dislikes and likes and dislikes. Prefer the word discipline, given that morality has a full load of our culture, but he begins by saying the purity of the Bodhisattva referred by the Sila. Sila is the name in Sanskrit of morality or discipline. This show Sila, which is written with an SH, the Sila Paramita is based upon making friends with oneself, loving oneself, you are not a nuisance to yourself anymore. You are good company, an inspiration to yourself. You do not have to control yourself so as to avoid temptations or follow rules or laws. It's interesting that he starts by oneself. Of course, because it's the bodhisattva, the description of a bodhisattva. And so a bodhisattva is a good friend of himself, loving oneself. You are good company to ourselves, an inspiration to yourself. Here it says, you do not have to control yourself so as to avoid temptations or follow rules and laws. You found temptations less relevant and guidelines less necessary, because you naturally follow the appropriate patterns. There is no need to try to be pure, to painfully discipline yourself to be pure, to apply detergent to your natural condition. The spotless or purity of the second paramita is realized when you acknowledge your natural purity, or we could say your Buddhahood. Now, a full-blown bodhisattva is like that. But what do we do? What do we do until we are there? Do we need simply to follow what feels good? Or do we need guidelines? Well, initial answer is we need guidelines, otherwise we won't have the 10 precepts, which are the guidelines of this paramita. Not to kill, not to lie, not to steal, and so forth. How do we go about it? Yes, we can reach, all of us can reach a stage we're fully expressing our bodhisattvic nature. We'll need less guidelines, laws. Because temptations will be less relevant. the less you give in into temptations, the less you need guidelines. They go hand in hand. If you give way to your temptations, you need guidelines. You find yourself not giving way to temptation and not falling into temptations because you have guidelines. That's in the story. They go hand in hand. Less temptations, less guidelines. Because you naturally follow the natural patterns. There's no need to try to be pure because you're already pure. Just to painfully discipline yourself to be pure. Painfully. Is that what we're doing here? All our pains in our knees and backs and emotional pain and doubts and questioning. One of the questionings in day three is, what am I doing here? Well, it sure hurts. Why am I willing to put up with all this sitting? I think it's a good example. It's like feeling naturally at home in a clean, orderly place. You do not have to fit yourself into it. If you try to fit yourself in, you become rigid and create chaos. That's true. When we force ourselves to be in a certain way, goes against our own true nature, we start doing stupid things. We're not following what we really should be doing. You become rigid, or I become rigid, and create chaos. So the morality of the bodhisattva is a natural process. Unskillful action becomes irrelevant, simply because we don't do it. The bodhisattva delights in working with people, rather than regarding compassionate duty, action as a duty. Before I became a teacher, I always admired the willingness of Roshi Kaplo and Bon Roshi to sit through Sishin, giving doksan after doksan. How can you do it? I would say. And now that I'm in the position of being in room, it is certainly a delight. It's a joy. to be with others. It's a joy to be in the sendo with others. It's a delight to share with others. The experiences during Sesshin. Share my own. Hear others share theirs. I really end up with all the benefits. By encouraging others, I encourage myself. By feeling the pain of others, I feel my own pain. The discomfort of others, I feel my own discomfort. By feeling the impatience of others, I feel my own impatience. By hearing others complain, I just don't get it. After so many sesshins, what's the problem with me? I say, yes. Yes, I'm still in the path. I am also working on myself. Might have just a little bit of experience, but that's it. That's it. I also yearn to keep working to get rid of this I. Go deeper into the koans. Be able to be in my breath practice full time. Not clinging to any thought. Letting them go by. When I used to still do work on koans, but before I would see how the teacher would see how the student, the monk asking a question, how he was doing and what he did, and identify myself with the student. Now, I just see the richness of the teachers and how they behave and how they act. I say, wow. It's so inspiring. To see both and how they interact and how they work together. And it's really a joy. It's a true joy. The Bodhisattva delights in working with people rather than regarding compassionate action as a duty. He has no dogma about how he should act or how other people should be. That is truly difficult. No dogma about how he should act or how other people should be. He does not try to reform or transform anyone because they do not fit his model. If people are determined to convert others into their mold, then they are attempting to reassure themselves by using the convert to relieve their doubt. The Bodhisattva is not concerned with conversion. Gee whiz. That is still difficult for me. How come you're not like me? How come you don't practice like me? Why don't you laugh like me? Why don't you say the same jokes like me? Why do you want to be the star? The one that gives out advice? Is that like me who being quiet? How come I want to convert the others? Well, I guess that's why we don't go knocking on doors on Sundays, huh? We can truly see in our relationship with loved ones this part. I cringe when I hear a mother say in the supermarket, "Baby, do like I do." Why can't they let the baby just be the baby? At a party and a kid does something wrong and 10 mothers jump at the same time or 10 parents jump at the same time. Don't do that. It's difficult for me. They don't fit his model. The Bodhisattva is not concerned with conversion. He respects other lifestyles, speaks their language, and allows them to evolve according to their nature, rather than making them into a replica of himself. Well, years back, I met a teacher. Interesting guy from Afghanistan. He was a Sufi teacher. He was always smoking, and when he walked around, he would carry among his two fingers, from the neck of the bottle, a bottle of beer. It's kind of a swagger there, of the cigarette in the other hand. walk. And around him were his entourage of students doing exactly what he was doing. They also had a bottle of beer and cigarette in their hands, just imitating. I don't know if he encouraged it or not. I didn't get to know him that well, but so interesting to see it from the outside. It requires tremendous discipline to avoid converting people. It's true. It's true. We all want to dice out advice. You should do this, you should do that. How come you did this? How come you did that? Someone tells you, oh, I dropped a pencil, it broke. It was my favorite pencil. How could you? It requires tremendous discipline to avoid converting people. Converting, telling them what to do. You should believe in this, you should believe in that. Bodhisattva would experience strong impulses to tell people how things ought to be. You hear that? Experience strong impulses to tell people how things ought to be. But instead of acting on these impulses, the Bodhisattva regards them, that is the impulses, not the people, as manure to work through and to work through. An expression of his insecurity. He no longer needs that kind of reinforcement. One type of discipline known as the gathering of virtue is connected with relating to physical beings. Physical things, sorry. Because the bodhisattvas have been well trained in samatha and vipassana, meditation, he does not relate to a cup of tea by knocking it over. Well, now he goes into a whole description of how well behaved the bodhisattvas are. And since I know you're all well behaved, I won't get into that. Bodhi's discipline is to relate to earth properly, to relate to his senses and mind properly. He's not concerned with psychic phenomena or other worlds. Ignoring earth to chase after psychic phenomena is like the play of children trying to find gold at the end of a rainbow. We do not have to concern ourselves with the cosmic world, the world of gods, psychic powers, angels and devils. To do so may be to lose track of the physical world in which we live, and this results in madness. The test of the bodhisattva's sanity is how directly he relates to earth. Anything else is a sidetrack. Well, psychics know what we need. So why not go and see them? Well, because really, Just as any other phenomena, any other person who gives you advice, they're biased. Yet, we seem to enjoy them sometimes. We like the magic. I would just like to compliment this morality issues by going to Stephen Batchelor, his book along with others, Moral Discipline. He brings them together. Morality and discipline brings it together and says moral discipline is a compound of two principal functions, those of restraint and activity. Restraint involves the maintaining of one's conduct within certain prescribed boundaries. These boundaries are fixed according to the disposition of the individual. In each case, they should provide defined space of action in which that person is enabled to most effectively actualize the process of the path. The various boundaries correspond to the various sets of vows of moral precepts. Laity, novice, monks, the nuns, the bodhisattvas, the yogins, and so forth. He's taking that, the vows from the, in all the sects, there's different vows for what you do with your practice. You're ordained, not ordained, so on and so forth. In another book, they describe that there's 253 vows for monks in the Tibetan tradition, and 362 for nuns. I don't know where they got so many more. A Buddhist Tibetan monk, I asked him once about this plethora of vows. He says, well, he told me they were added as or needed, depending on what was happening. And he gave me an example of this. For instance, there's one of them, which I did not take because I didn't feel it was necessary, is not to sit on top of babies. Your reaction was exactly my reaction. Not to sit on top of babies. That's number 200 and something. And I looked puzzled at him and said, you've seen pictures, photographs of Tibet. You know it's cold, and you see the huts where people live, and up there in the mountain. And he says they don't have beds like we do. They don't have sofas like we do. They just have endless amount of cushions. And they wrap up babies in many blankets to keep them warm. And they put them among cushions. And here comes the Lama, and they said, "Would you kindly sit down, Master, while I give you some tea?" And he, in the darkness of the room, he doesn't distinguish that that's not a cushion, it's a baby asleep. And so they do a vow of looking at the cushion before sitting to make certain that it's not a baby. So, it's interesting how we make up as we go. New guidelines of how we should behave. Like, say, imagine we had a monitor who loved to tell jokes. We had a teacher that did not like jokes. And here is the monitor just cracking up jokes. Well, we would have a guideline. It says, in Zendo, monitors will not tell jokes. But that's how we go about. That's how a moral conduct comes. Okay, let's go back to here. The nun, the bodhisattva, the yogin, and so forth. The essence of moral discipline is not merely the control of one's outward behavior, but the control of the psychological factors that are responsible for the overt acts of body and speech. So we're responsible not only of not doing it, not only the control, I shall not do it, I shall not do it, I shall not eat that cookie, I shall not eat that cookie. No, I should not eat between meals, no, or whatever. But one is responsible for the psychological factors that want me to eat that cookie. Psychological factors that are responsible for the overt acts of body and speech. That makes perfect sense. To achieve such control requires the development of constant mindfulness of the moral boundaries one has accepted for oneself, an ever-present alertness to watch for any disruptive mental factors that may cause one to transgress that boundary. About if I feel so insecure, or I have such low self-esteem, I'm always saying a little bit of a lie when I describe myself to make myself bigger, more important, because within myself I feel so small, I could just disappear. I add a little bit here, a little bit there, a little bit there, a little bit there, here and there. I spice it up. The problem with that kind of things is that one loses what is true about oneself and what isn't true about oneself. And it all just started because one feels one needs to say something about oneself that, well, at least they'll admire me for this. And you might not see it in yourselves today, but as teenagers, I remember that we would always kind of try to build ourselves up so that we would be someone in the group of friends and try to impress girlfriends or the opposite sex. Try to boost our chances. Once we've learned that, it's difficult to break away sometimes, and it takes a constant awareness of what we're doing. Their underlying causes that take us to transgress the vows or the precepts and hurt others, hurt ourselves. Easily see it in oneself, I'm sure. Do it all the time. And when there's a pattern, you find yourself in a pattern, do take a look at it. Or I take a look at it. I see a pattern, a behavior of falling into the same harmful pattern of transgression, or just simply of needing something that's not there. With the presence of such mindfulness and alertness, the grosser disturbances of the mind can be avoided, thus creating a basic tranquility in which concentration and wisdom can be effectively cultivated. The second aspect of moral discipline is that of activity. This is the positive counterpart to restraint that is enabled us to operate because of the calm borders established through restraint, while at the same time adding further strength to those boundaries. Generally speaking, this activity refers to any actualization of authentic being that forms part of the path. More specifically, it involves the cultivation of the positive counterparts to whatever one is attempting to restrain from. If one's restraints includes reframing from taking life, for example, the positive counterpart would be to consciously save and protect life. In this way, we take the restraint of restraint. In this way, the task of restraint is obviously facilitated and strengthened. And with that, we'll finish this Teisho and have the four vowels.